All right, welcome everybody. Erev Tov, time to get started. First of all, I want to thank the Thor and Simon families, Tova Shimon, I think she pronounced it, who comes to so many of our classes, a real regular at Torah Motion. We want to thank her for sponsoring the observance of the Yahrzeit today, Bobo Yom, the 28th of Adar, where their father, grandfather, and great-grandfather, Yosef Mordechai ben Eliezer and Fega, who taught the family to love Torah, Israel, life, and nature. So Tova and the extended family, thank you very much for sponsorship and the Shama Shel Aben Eliyah. We should merit to celebrate many happy occasions. Thank you. And now it's a pleasure to welcome, you know, Shira Hech-Koller, so who I worked with so hard in the summer, and now finally get a chance to hear her. Really, I want to thank her and for her work at 929. As you know, we ran our Tanakh program in the summer, you know, 24 and 8, the 24 books in 8 weeks, 3 mornings. And it was really, you know, Shira behind the scenes, who was we worked on it together, helped with, you know, speakers and publicity and all kinds of things. I want to thank her. And she continues together with Rabbi Adam Mintz, working for 929. And she's, of course, the director of the English part of 929, the 929 Prakim of Tanakh. She's is a lawyer. She worked in a Wall Street law firm, but I think that's long ago history. Like I'm an accountant, you know, like I'm an accountant, like, you know, 15 years ago, and even more. And she taught at SAR, a high school at Jerisha, and it's a pleasure to welcome her to Torah Motion to give our weekly Parshat HaShavuot shiur. Bakasha Shira.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you so much, Rabbi Kelman. Thank you to all the sponsors. Thank you to everyone for being here. I know Thursday night, 8:30, my kids are still running around somewhere, so it's never an easy time, but it's just wonderful to be able to learn with all of you tonight. I invite you to turn on your cameras if you would like, so we can have, you know, dynamics to your faces, but of course, understand if it's not appropriate or convenient. So I'm excited to be learning together. Just one note in terms of, I think the chat box is open for questions, conversations. I likely will not be looking at it as we, right, as I teach, but will at the end kind of scroll through the chat to extract some of the questions. So today we have a double parsha, right? Vayakhel Pekudei. And I wanted to take this moment as we're closing up Sefer Shemot and with all the details of the construction and the completion of the construction of the Mishkan, as an opportunity to sort of take a step back and reflect together on the concept of sacred space, both conceptually and practically. I've been thinking a lot about this, both as part of a fellowship that I'm doing this year at an Institute for Experiential Education in Jewish Pedagogy, how to use concepts of sacred space as a practical pedagogical component. And more broadly, we are in a moment where a year in, our sacred spaces, our sense of space and place, and our conceptions of space and place have been so radically shifted and altered that it creates new opportunities for different conceptions of what space is and what sacred space really is. So what I'm going to do tonight, to give you a bit of a roadmap, I want to open with a series of questions. In just a moment, I'll put up some slides, practical questions, which, just full disclosure, we won't answer, we won't address, but I think they're important practical questions when we think about space and we think about sacred space that hit on some of the core issues surrounding our own practical construction of sacred space. And I think they can inform all of our conversations, and they should be, you know, hovering and framing this conversation. And then we'll jump into the textual learning, which I hope will inform some of the practical. So I'm going to just share the screen here before we get to the source, before we get to the sources, and just offer, right? Everyone good? Can you see? Thumbs up. Okay, great. Just offer some practical questions that can arise when we think about space, when we think about sacred space. And we'll just read them together in 1 minute just to go through a few questions. I think they're important for our own environments and lives right now. So the first question I would ask is, to what extent actually do our physical environments influence both our intellectual and spiritual lives? Is it something that we as individuals and as a community think about regularly? Certainly over the last year, we've thought about it regularly, but outside of that context, is the sense of space something over which we as a community have control? What are we to do when we're stuck with less than ideal spaces, limitations, and constraints on our space? These can be in our shuls, in our schools, in our batei midrash, in our camps, in our homes, right? To what extent do our physical environments shape and influence our discourse and our identities? Sorry, I think I was just muted there. I don't know if that was all good. Okay, well, Ginzi, so to what extent do our physical environments shape and influence our discourse, our identities, and our communities? Who's charged with making decisions about communal use of space? Does there exist room for meaningful input, both in terms of, right, again, our sacred spaces, our traditional sacred spaces, our shuls, our schools, our homes? Can we add, as we shift more and more at this moment to permanent online spaces, how do we apply theories and conceptions of sacred space to all of these new platforms? In what way do our computers become sacred space? Will they continue to be sacred spaces when a platform like this ends up being a place, a portal for tefillah, for learning? What does that mean for the use of the platform? In what ways can our online spaces actually be transformed into sacred ones? These are just some of a few questions. Are restrictions required to be put into place in order to sanctify spaces? We'll look at some of the sources that engage with that question. Right? If so, what are they? What restrictions are necessary to create a sacred space? Who is charged with implementing them? How does all of that translate into virtual spaces? And the question that we'll be thinking about tonight together for the next 50 minutes is, how can our sacred texts inform our practices of designing and creating sacred spaces? What conceptions can we take and what models can we take from this week's Parsha, Parsha Yot, and from general questions about sacred space in Tanakh, in rabbinic literature? And finally, before we get to our sources and our deep dive into the sources, I wanted to just share a reflection from Alain de Botton, who's a Swiss philosopher and architect and a writer on a lot of contemporary issues, who wrote a wonderful work called The Architecture of Happiness. And in this section, there's a certain tension that I think is very powerful in terms of highlighting our own internal drives. So he says, we seem divided between an urge to override our senses and numb ourselves to our settings. Let me get a little bit bigger. I think I can, maybe not. And a contradictory impulse to acknowledge the extent to which our identities are indelibly connected to and will shift along with our locations. An ugly room can coagulate any loose suspicions as to the incompleteness of life, while a sunlit one set with honey-colored limestone tiles can lend support to whatever is most helpful within us. Belief in the significance of architecture is premised on the notion that we are, for better or for worse, different people in different places, and on the conviction that it is architecture's task to render vivid to us who we might ideally be. Stop this chair for just a moment. I think the tension that's highlighted in that piece is we have contradictory impulses. We are different people in different places. And there's a particular discomfort to that, right? When I think about that, I'm a little bit uncomfortable that our identities shift based on our locations. Because we want to believe that we're actually not so little and not so base as to be so greatly impacted by our settings. But we are, right? We are, and the color of the walls and the books behind us and the environment and the flowers that we have actually indelibly impact our experiences, our religious experiences, our familial experiences, our intellectual experiences. And so I wanted to frame just in a few minutes those questions as sort of hovering and looming. And of course, I'll share those. Those aren't on your source sheet, but I'm happy to share that link so you have those questions. I have many more such questions. But the idea is that these are practical questions. And now we'll go back and look at, right, and look at some of the theories, look at the sacred texts that can inform our understanding of sacred space. So I think all of you got the source packet. I will share it together now. And we're going to start here with our Parsha, but our Parsha, our Parshiyot, the end of Sefer Shemot, as a harking back to something earlier. So when we look at the completion of the creation of the Mishkan and the description of the language, we see, as we read through the end of Sefer Shemot, a number of psukim, which are reminiscent of the beginning of Sefer Bereshit. And so, in fact, as we read through these passages, and I'll, you know, I have the sources up here, but actually I'm going to shift to the chart that I made, which is a bit simpler to follow. When we think and when we look at what happens in Shemot, Lamed Tet, and Mem, the end of Parshat Pekudei, when the Mishkan is being set up in its final stages of completion, we see that the passage here, the biblical passage here, is laden with imagery from earlier passages, from Bereshit, the end of Bereshit Aleph, and the beginning of Perek Bet. The two narratives are really connected by some of the most important vocabulary that we see here, right? Vayar Moshe et kol hamlacha, v'hinei asu ota, ka'asher tziva Hashem kein asu. Moshe saw the work that he did, right? The work of the Mishkan was completed. Moshe finished himself the melacha, and he blessed it, and he sanctified it. This language pulls us back immediately to the beginning of Sefer Bereshit. That same language, Vayar Elokim et kol asher asah, on the right side, right? God saw all of that he did. The English is actually up here. Sorry that it's on different pages, but the verbs, the parallel verbs, are what's significant for us. Vayar, Vayechulu, Hashamayim Va'aretz v'chol tza'am. And the sky and the earth was completed. Vayichal Elokim, that same language, and God completed. Vayivarech Elokim, and God blessed. Vayikadesh Oto, and he sanctified. We have this exact language that is essentially saying, on one level, right, creation does end with Shabbat. But actually, creation is not truly concluded until the Mishkan is completed. And all of the parts are set up. And the physical is now transmitted into something spiritual that will contain. This is picked up. There's a quote here from Rabbi Dr. Joshua Berman, right? The second sentence, pulling upon that parallel. The composite parts of the physical world are completed on the sixth day of creation, but the ultimate purpose of these elements, to be dedicated to the service of God, is only realized once the sanctuary is built, to serve as a universal focal point for the service of God. This, in fact, is picked up in the Midrash, and there's a long Midrash here. Again, I included a lot of the sources, not necessarily going through all of them, but so that you see that this is picking up on, right, an earlier source that's picking up on the textual parallels. The Midrash Tanchuma on this week's Parsha. The Midrash is, you know, a collection of Agadic Midrashim from about the 7th or 8th century, some of them perhaps even earlier. But the Midrash here picks up on this similar point, links the verbal parallels between creation and construction of the Mishkan, and draws the conclusion that the place of the Mishkan is equivalent to the construction of the world, right? This is the end. This is what the ultimate purpose was for. And the imagery is actually one of partnership. That's picked up on as we continue to think about man's role in the creation of the Mishkan and the construction of the Mishkan. Man, humanity, right? Humans are partners in the process of creation. And in building the Mishkan, Chazal are pointing to this connection in a number of different ways, but in particular, looking at Bezalel, the architect of the Mishkan, and say, Chazal say here in Masechet Brachot in the Babylonian Talmud in Brachot Nun Hei Amud Aleph, that Bezalel was endowed with particular God-like qualities to essentially say man is a full partner in the process of creation. And the construction of the Mishkan is finally completing that process. This is a two-book unit. Starts in the beginning of Bereshit, where we have sacred time in Bereshit, right? We end creation of the world with Shabbat and the sanctification of time, but we don't have the completion of that process until all the way at the end of Sefer Shemot with the construction of the Mishkan. And here the Gemara says, Amarav Yudea Haya Bitzalel Tsaref Otiot Shenivru Bahan Shamayim Va'aretz. Bitzalel knew how to combine the letters through which the heavens and earth were created. And it pulls a textual parallel, right? The Gemara says, Ktiv Hacha, Bimaleo Toruach Elokim, Bechachma, Ubitzmuna, Ubedat. Uktiv Hatam, Hashem Bechachma, Yisarat, Kunin Shamayim, Bitzmuna, Uktiv Bedato, Tehomot Nifkiu. The language that's used to describe God in Mishle, right? Mishle Perek Gimel, in the third chapter of Mishle, right? Hashem, by wisdom, founded the earth. By understanding, established the heavens. By knowledge, the depths were broken up. The Gemara says that exact language is used to describe Bezalel's actions in creation of the Mishkan. So he knew the letters by which to create the world. We have the same language of Chochmah, Tfunah, and Da'at, essentially saying that Bezalel was endowed with godlike qualities, or if we put it in another way, man, humanity, in the process of completing the Mishkan, in the architecture, in the work, in the involvement, in the details, in the construction, is actually completing godlike work. And so we see, we have a completion here of a two-part unit, right? At the beginning of Perek Aleph, Bereishit, there really is no sacred space. There's really no place for God and man to meet one another. And here I'll, because I happen to share an architectural space, a home, with the man who wrote this article, Aaron Kohler, I'll just quote my husband, which I don't normally do, but he put it nicely in an essay in Mitoch HaOel. It's a collection of professors and rabbis of YU, and I'll borrow some of his language here when he talks about, right, the important transitions that we see in this two-book unit. We see a number of phases coming to an end, right? First, God has, here in the middle of the, where it says three important transitions, God has, so to speak, handed off to mankind the job of creation, as Buber said. Second, and in what may be a related development, the focus has shifted from sacred time to sacred space. When God's act of creation is described, what he completes and what he blesses is a fragment of time. When human creation is narrated, they create, complete, and give sanctity to a fragment of space. And third, and I think this is the most powerful when we think about kind of the developments of a people, God has found his home. It's been observed that elsewhere in the ancient Near East, when a god is said to have created the world, immediately following that is the temple that's constructed for him or her. In Chumash, these expectations are foiled. God's own creation, full of such order and promise in Bereishit's Perek Aleph, crashed in the face of the reality of Eden in Bereishit's Perek Gimel, again in Noach's generation in Perek Vav, and again in the valiant Shinar in Yud Aleph. The entire first part of Chumash may be read as God's search for man, or more precisely, God's search for a sacred space among man. Finally, in the second half of Shemot, though still outside that promised land, man has, on the orders of God, created a space within their own space for God himself. And this first act of the grand drama ends on a crescendo of accomplishments, and yet with the promise of an even more transcendent future. Now that the Mishkan is built, the cloud of God will live among man forevermore. I'm going to stop the share for just 1 second so I can see your faces. And ask, you know, some critical questions here in highlighting some of the points that emerge in that first unit and in that selection from that essay. Thinking back to Bereishit, right? So we have this unit now. This is a two-book unit that starts with creation in Bereishit, ends with the construction of the Mishkan in the 40th Perek, Perek Mem, in Parshat Pekudei. When we think about space, in Perek Beth of Genesis, the second chapter in creation of the world, and there's no actual sacred space, right? There's no place for God and man to meet. And I think that's really an important perception when we think about the development of a people, the development of a tribe, the development of a clan, development of a grouping with a particular identity, right? In the second chapter in Perek Beth of Bereishit and Gan Eden, There's a sacred space, but it doesn't last very long. There's Gan Eden, but it's bounded, and Adam and Chava are quickly thrown out. And we have all the narratives that transpire in the book of Genesis, in Bereishit, and there's no place where actually God and man are supposed to meet. What does that mean, right? I think, again, we won't answer those questions right now, but it's a point to ponder on that all of those narratives of development, of covenant, of family, of bondage, of slavery, of freedom, of law, of justice, of society, all take place outside of a structure where God and man have a place to meet. It's outside of that context. And I think there's something very, very powerful about that. When you think about the development of a people, when you think about the development of a society, sometimes the places distract. We can, you know, think about that in terms of a family, I would say, developing as a unit. One might argue, couple gets married, they buy a house right away. There is a certain, right, impulse to build the house, do construction, knock down the walls, become, right, concerned with the details of the home. Whereas you might say, start your life, live in something simple, develop your family, work on the values, then transplant it into a space that actually knows what it needs to hold, what it needs to carry. Don't worry about the place in which you're living. Use your experiences, create the people that you need to be, and then there will be that context for it at a later point. So I think there are a number of different, right, really interesting avenues for exploration when we think about the Mishkan as completing the process much earlier on, and without that space, without that context for people, right, to meet, to engage. So that's when we get to the end of Sefer Shemot, we're actually going back to something, and that's where the Midrash is pointing on the verbal similarities. Chazal are putting Bezalel in there, saying Bezalel is a marker, is a messenger, is some sort of model of a God-like creator. You know, he's not God, but like endowed with those same qualities, those same ability to look and see what needs to be constructed and created. So now as we're finishing Sefer Shemot, we're actually really going back to something much, much earlier. And so I want to kind of move now into different conceptions of the Mishkan and the Mishkan vis-a-vis the Mikdash. It's a little bit of a digression from our parshiot per se. We'll touch upon them, and then we'll kind of circle back to the details in the end of Perek Mem in Parshat Pekudei. So when we think about the Mishkan, and we'll get back to the sources in just one second, there are a lot of different elements that we can think about in terms of how the Mishkan's construction informs our actual sense of space. And I want to focus on three elements together right now. One is location of the Mishkan vis-a-vis the people. Now we have a number of different depictions throughout Sefer Shemot and also Sefer Bamidbar. The sources are there. We'll get to them in just one moment, but I do like to see your faces. And there is a sort of discrepancy as to where the Mishkan was actually located vis-a-vis the people, right? What was the physical placement? What is the space that it occupied? You can kind of see different conceptions when we look at the text itself, and those different conceptions actually portray different conceptions of religious existence, of relationship with God, right? Some of the sources, we'll see, place the Mishkan at the center, right? It's initially set up in Sefer Shemot at the center. Now, again, that might be, it might be conceptual. At the beginning of Bamidbar, the travels of the Shvatim, of the tribes, are all organized around the Mishkan and Prakim Gimel and Dalet, the Mishkan at the center, right? There's sort of this sacred center, capstone of the universe. God is manifest. We know where to find him. Mishkan at the center represents a particular ideology, right? Philosophy, way of accessing the divine, way of accessing religious life and existence. We also have, on the other hand, the Mishkan at the periphery. Now, this comes into a separate discussion in Shemot, Perek Lamed Gimel, chapter 33. and in Sefer Bamidbar and a number of Perkimin Yud Aleph and Yud Bet, we have the Mishkan and the Ohel Moed at the periphery, at the somewhere located outside of the camp, at some distance from the people, perhaps an aftermath of Chet HaEgel, right? And there's a lot of discussion here. We're not going to, you know, get into the Rishonim and the discussion for our purposes because time is short, but there are different depictions. There's also a different sense because there's different terminology used, is the Mishkan and the Mishkan Ohel Moed, the tent of meeting, the same thing? Are these different things? We have two different spaces, two different places, two different terminologies that are used. And they're not necessarily, right? There's a, you know, Rashi, Ramban, all the major medievalists kind of engage with this question. Are these the same? Are these the same place? Was one a precursor? There's an excellent article by Dr. Zev Farber, I'm happy to share with you afterwards, that kind of works through all the different classical and critical scholarship as to what perhaps is the difference between the tabernacle and the tent of meeting. Are they the same? Are they not? For our purposes, I want to raise the question. One is located in the center. One is located on the periphery, right? We have depictions where Moshe appears to be leaving the camp in order to speak to Hashem in the Ohel Moed, right? In the case of when Miriam gets Tzara'at, in the case of the Shivim Zikanim, we see very clearly Moshe's leaving the middle and kind of going out to the periphery to access God in the Ohel Moed. God doesn't dwell there necessarily all the time, but pops up sort of on appropriate occasions to reveal himself to Moshe, reveal himself to Yehoshua. And that is a sense of an isolated tent. And I think it raises all sorts of questions as to what's the difference between these two depictions. And here, let me go back to the source sheet so we can. One second. Let me just have a look. And I included the sources for, you know, the center versus the periphery, God at the center versus God at a periphery. So you have just the sources here. So if you want to look them up afterwards, but the ideas are what interests me right now in terms of sacred space. What are the different depictions reflect? What's the significance of a God at the center versus a God at the periphery? What are the different religious ideologies that are represented, that are manifest by such different physical placements? How do we as people, how did B'nai Israel, how did Moshe, how did Yehoshua experience God at the center or at the periphery? And I think we also can ask questions about our own sacred spaces when we think about the practical applications here. In creating any space, in creating any sacred space, what do we place at the center? What is at the periphery? What are the advantages of placing something at the center? And what do we get when we have it at the periphery? Now, I would argue, and here I have a, you know, quote here from Professor Ben Sommer, who's a professor at GTS. I'm going to summarize this, but again, I like to include a lot of sources for anybody to look at afterwards. I think it's sometimes more engaging if I can summarize it for you. But essentially what Professor Sommer says in a long article about the conflicting constructions of the Mishkan, he reflects essentially saying that these two depictions reflect very different religious ideologies. Described here, he quotes the historian of religion, J.Z. Smith, and he calls, right, a God who's at the center is a God who's accessible. By carefully following out particular instructions, exacting rituals, there are places that are holy. And by following that sense of ritual, it makes the place holy. And then an individual actually knows where to go to access God. There's something there when the Mishkan is represented as the middle, we know where to access the holy. As opposed to, right, a God at the periphery of the camp, in our context, it's a little bit more critical of the whole idea of there being one particular sacred space, right? The idea that Moshe has to go out and seek God somewhere outside of the camp, that Yehoshua has to go out, has to leave the people. It means that things are more open and less predictable, less constraints, perhaps, right? There's a certain value of chaos and creativity, of openness, where we say we can actually bring God in everywhere. And so these two different depictions of the Mishkan and the placement of the Mishkan actually say in this one, maybe there's a certain sacred messiness, right? If I know exactly what I need to do, so there's something comforting. I know where to go to pray. I know where to go to daven. I know where to go to speak to God or to live a religious life extended in all kinds of ways. It's not just about the conversation with Hashem, right? It's a sense of how do I access the religious in my life? It's predictable. A sacred space at the center tells me things are predictable and I can know where to go. And yet a sacred at the periphery means there's a little bit more work that needs to be done, but it also means that the religious existence can kind of find itself and manifest itself in all kinds of ways. You know, and I think just in terms of thinking about what it means to be a Jew, right? To be a Jew is to accept the exact and exacting ritual requirements laid out in halacha, to live by them, to understand that this is the way we kind of access, right? Access the godliness, but also to realize that a religion that consists only of the exacting ritual requirements is actually not enough. And that's what the peripheral Mishkan represents, or the Ohel Moed on the periphery tells us we need to express a relationship with God in ways that are surprising to us, that are surprising towards, right, the system. And we have both of these, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim him, right? Those and those are the words of a living God. They're kind of living together, like the Talmud teaches us in Masechet Erevin. There's different depictions and they live in harmony. And I think ultimately when we think about the Mishkan, that's, right, a point that we can bring home when we think about all of our sacred spaces, all of the places we construct. There's predictability, and then there's that which we have to, right, be creative, and those live together in harmony in terms of the sacred community. That's sort of point one when we think about particular questions of sacred that the Mishkan can teach us in transforming our own religious existence in terms of sacred space and the placement of sacred space. Point two, and I'll do this very, very briefly, is conceptions of transience versus rootedness, right? When we close up this week's parashiyot, we see that the Mishkan is constructed in ways that are suitable for transience. That's the whole idea. The whole idea is that this is for desert conditions. This is a sacred space that's going to be moved around. And the materials are ones that are used for impermanent mobility, right? We're moving. There are curtains, the shittim and the thorny branches that are made to be able to be taken up and down. And there's a sense that we're mobile, we're not rooted. And we think about our religious spaces. I think there's this, you know, moment right now, we're on our laptops taking our sacred spaces everywhere. Megillah is being read and I'm in the middle and I have my iPad in the living room. And then we go upstairs, right? We have, or we're living in existence, what I would say right now, of a Mishkan existence. It's kind of moving all over. One day children are in school, one day they're at home. Tefillah is happening through portals of digital, right, laptops, and they're happening in a real dimension of a sidur. And so we're living this Mishkan existence as compared to a Mikdash existence, right? A certain particular rootedness. The materials are entirely different. And you know, we're not comparing right now, but it's just very interesting when we think about the Mishkan, right, the tabernacle versus the Beit HaMikdash. Actually, like the setup was the same, right? The proportions, dimensionality are identical in these two structures. The location of all the various kelim, the utensils, is exactly the same, just totally different structures, totally different size, but the basic direction, the entranceway from the east to the west is entirely the same, but it's a difference of materials It's a difference in nature of the structure. It's a difference in dimensions. It's a difference in terms of what the purpose is for that moment. So I think a second question, when we think about sacred space as emanating from this week's parsha, tells us we live sometimes, again, with that tension. Now, there's a theme of sacred space and tension that's evolving and developing towards it, right? Again, we have a particular kind of paradox here, the paradox of I'm everywhere, but I'm nowhere. Or I'm everywhere, and then sometimes I'm rooted somewhere, and I can't leave that. And there's something very comforting about the rootedness. So when we think about the Mishkan sacred space versus the Mikdash sacred space, again, that's another paradox that plays out in all different kinds of ways in our practical lives. And the third dimension is what I will call hierarchical versus perhaps, as we'll see in a moment, egalitarian space. Okay, when we look here, what you have here is just a rendition of the architecture of the Beit HaMikdash. And for our purposes, what we see is that the space is actually very hierarchical, right? You move through one portal into another portal towards the Kodesh Kodashim, and at each level, it becomes more and more restricted. And here's where restriction and the concept of Kedusha go hand in hand, right? Placing restrictions on particular space, the more Kadosh something is, then the more restrictions we will have on the particular space. And so when we look at the Beit HaMikdash, there's a particular hierarchy when you walk through it, right? You're walking through space that gets increasingly more and more restrictive, more and more kadosh. Fewer and fewer people can kind of move through this space and access, so that the ultimately we have the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur is the only person that could go in the Kodesh Kodashim. Otherwise, right, we have levels. And there's something very interesting about looking at the Beit HaMikdash and the architecture and layout of the Beit HaMikdash, perhaps as compared, we'll scroll up here, to other contemporaneous temples. I mean, I just thought this was an interesting depiction. What you have here is a picture of the temple, the great temple at Megiddo, which is right, the early Bronze Age, about 3500 BCE. There's just a really interesting archaeological kind of findings. We have excavations, pretty recent excavations from the early Bronze Age Megiddo. It's about North Israel, 30 kilometers south of Haifa. Right, Armageddon, known for its historical, geographical, and all sorts of theological importance. But there's archaeological evidence of this very, very complex society and this monumental construction that's really unparalleled anywhere else in the Levant. And at the center of that is the great temple of Megiddo. And the reason I just want to bring it here is, I mean, there's all kinds of questions about the community. There was a very large settlement, complex labor that was required to build something like this. But I'm raising it for a sacred space question, because essentially the remains of this temple are defined by two elements. It's a broad room design. So a little bit, it looks like that sense of the Mishkan. And there is a central ground level with stones and slabs at regular intervals. And you'll see those dots represent, right, the slabs at intervals. And the significance here is that to me, when I look at this space, the space here is much less hierarchical, right? There's no hierarchy in this space. And it evokes a totally different kind of feel than the space that you feel when you walk through the hierarchical nature of the Beit HaMikdash. And I think that kind of leads to, you know, to questions and conceptions. And I include here a number of different Mishnayot in Masechet Kelim that reflect hierarchy of space. And when we think about distinctively Jewish spaces, when we think about the Mishkan, right, as a marker of space, we have that hierarchy of space, not just in the Mishkan itself, but in the levels of holiness. And I'll read the first line in Hebrew, and then again, these Mishnayot were just to evoke a sense of hierarchical nature of Kiddushah that we feel in very real ways in the Beit HaMikdash, perhaps as compared to other spaces, but in the Mishkan and the Beit HaMikdash, you move through that space and you feel it. And the Mishnah says, Eser Kiddushotein, Eretz Yisrael, Mikudesha, Mikval HaRatzot, Mahi Kiddushata, Shmevi'in Mimena, HaOmer, HaBikurim, B'Shtei Alechem, Mashein Mevi'in, Kein Mikval HaRatzot. There are 10 levels, there are 10 grades of holiness. And the Mishnah kind of moves through holiness of space and says the land of Israel is holier than all other lands. And what's the nature of the holiness? And it goes through from Eretz Israel, you bring the Korban Omer, the first fruits, the Shtei HaLechem, the two loaves of bread, which can't be brought from any other lands. And then the Mishnah continues, right, in this sense of hierarchies and says cities that are walled are holier than cities that are not walled. And it goes through why, having to do, right, the details of the leper, the mitzora. And then it continues, right? I'm not going to read the entirety of the Mishnah, but I want you just to get a feel and a flavor of this sense that emanates from the hierarchies in the Mishkan, in the Beit HaMikdash, actually is a much larger hierarchical nature that we see codified in halakha here in the Mishnah, that the area within the walls of Yerushalayim is holier because there are certain things and there's certain, right, the Maser Sheni can be eaten there and it can't be eaten elsewhere. And then the Temple Mount is even holier than the area within the walls of Yerushalayim because, right, a woman who's a nida or a yoledet right after having a child can't enter it. And it continues and continues. The chel, the chatzer, the courtyard, and it moves through the Beit HaMikdash, the ulam, the heichal, the kodesh kodashim, et cetera, et cetera. The idea here is that you move through this space and you feel it. And I think this raises all kinds of questions in an age of democratization and an age of egalitarianism and an age where we're seeing restrictions fall by the wayside in all kinds of ways. There's a depth of sometimes you move through something and you feel the restrictions which actually craft that sense of sacred, that sense of space, and the design and layout gives us the ethos of what that space should feel like and does feel like. Now, there's a lot more in terms of hierarchical space and hierarchical laws. Again, just giving a flavor of some of the different conceptions. I want to contrast that with a different kind of space, and then we're going to return back to our parsha and tie it all together. This, again, I thought was very interesting when we think about design and layout of the Beit HaMikdash. It's interesting to compare the Mishkan and the Mikdash to the home in the ancient Near East. And again, this is based, with a depiction that you have here, was based on the work of Avraham Faust and Shlomo Bunimovitz. Avraham Faust is a professor at Bar Ilan, and Bunimovitz is an Israeli archaeologist who did a lot of work and a lot of writing on the typical Iron Age home. So, you know, around 1300 BCE, so we would say 500 BCE is the Iron Age. There was a very typical home, a contemporaneous to what we're talking about in terms of the temples. There was the home, and a typical Israelite home was what we would call a four-room house. And you see a few different depictions of the four-room house on the screen right now. Now, there are hundreds of four-room houses that, you know, are known from the Iron Age. And they're concentrated mainly in Israel in the north, in the Galil, right, the remains, the archaeological remains, in the central hill country. And that's really like the typical dominant home of the Iron Age. And it's really unparalleled in any other period. But we see this space that was considered, right, this is an ancient Israelite home. And there's lots and lots of questions about this depiction of space. How did it function? What are its origins? What's the relationship between the home and the people, right? Who, the demographics and the society? Why was it so popular? What's really, really interesting here is that these homes are backed by sort of like a broad room entrance or some kind of central space. And each one of the rooms, I think as you see in the first depiction, each of the rooms can be accessed by this central space. Now, what's really interesting about this home, right? So this was the Israelite, this was the Jewish home in the Iron Age. These were fundamentally different from the Canaanite and Phoenician homes of the same period. The Canaanite homes, right? The archaeological evidence points to homes that were hierarchical in their nature. You can only get to a room, master bedroom, by passing through other rooms. There was a hierarchy of access. There was a hierarchy of space. And so, the grandparents had the most private room, which was all the way at the end, and everybody else's rooms would be passed in order to get these were sort of multi-family dwellings in order to get to that last room. And there's all kinds of reasons why and speculation as to why the Israelite home looked this way, right? It's much more equal. It's much more egalitarian. There was a chatzer, there was something in the middle, and you can access all the different rooms either from the middle or from the area behind. And, the reigning theory is that this had to do with the separation of purity and impurity. Again, questions of separation and the sacred going hand in hand. According to the rules of Tum'ah and Tahara, menstruants would be allowed to stay in a house like this because the room is offset. It's an entirely different space. It's a different room. Whereas in other cultures, if the rooms you can't have under the same ohel, under the same space, the Tum'ah, Nidah, all different kinds of impurity. And if there wasn't a separate room, in a hierarchical space, then we would have to exclude a person who is tamei from this home. And so the design here, right, of this home, actually, you can access all the different rooms from a central space that facilitates a particular separation between purity and impurity, right? Purity could be kept in the home, even with an impure person in the home, because a pure person or the impure person could avoid the room entirely. And I raise this because I think it's just really interesting to see space, right? When we think about sacred space, and if the norm was a hierarchical nature of space in the Mishkan and the Mikdash, suddenly in the house, we see a very different kind of space. It's much more, we would say, egalitarian in its ethos. And I'll read some of the language here. Line at the beginning from an article called The Four Room House. It's a great article. The relation between a society and its architecture is reflexive. People structure their built environments, and the latter in turn structures people's perceptions of space. In other words, as Winston Churchill once said, we shape our buildings, thereafter they shape us. And continue to the bolded section, skipping a little bit here, but I invite you to read it on your own. This is often manifested in hierarchical grading of accessibility and structural depth of spaces within the house related to generational and in some cases gender-based status distinctions. The four-room plan lacks depth or access hierarchy, thus expressing a more egalitarian spirit. By living in the house, its occupants absorb the values embodied in it, thus ensuring the continuity of the ethos itself. Again, a sense of perhaps this was for the right to facilitate the laws of purity and impurity of Tum'ah and Tahara. But what ends up happening when you structure a space in this way is that the whole entire home feels much more equal, feels much, much less hierarchical. And there's a place for hierarchy, right? In ancient Israel, the Mikdash was a place for hierarchy. Right, to access that which is sacred, you need to move through hierarchies. But what they're arguing, and we can argue with them, I'm not entirely convinced, but I think it's a very interesting reflection on what the status or what the feel of a home could potentially have felt like as compared to the religious spaces. Now, that was all those, those were just three distinct areas to think about ways that space actually influences how we behave, how we act, what we do, what our values are, how we access God, how we relate to one another, all sort of emanating from our parsha. And I want to return now to our parsha, our parshiot. I'll stop the screen share for just a minute. We took a little bit of a tour to think about the different dimensions, and I want to anchor and end in Sefer Shemot and the end of Sefer Shemot. In Parshat Pekudei, we read of the completion of the construction as all the component parts are brought to Moshe, who sets it up, he erects it, he anoints it, he initiates along with Aaron and his four sons into the priesthood. And we have two parshiot of details of the command to build the Mishkan that was back in Truma and Tetzaveh. Now we have in Vayakel and Pekudei, many of those same details all repeated, right? In much the same language, as the Torah tells us now that those details and commands are actually fulfilled. And the fulfillment here, right, anchoring back into our construct, the fulfillment seems critically important. It's as if the Torah is telling us, you actually know what's going to happen. You know from the earlier parshiot what's going to happen. We laid it all out. We laid all the details of the vessels. You know exactly what's going to happen. But now watch. Pay very careful attention as it all unfolds. Each step, each piece of metal, each color of dye, each sheet of fabric, right? It's explicated, and each one of them is worthy of our attention, not just in the instruction manual that we saw beforehand, but in the actual construction. And it's as if the Torah is saying, now we know that the Torah is very famously brief in its narratives and very short on any unnecessary description, but here it's the details that are being treasured, right? We get a step-by-step recounting because the work is actually not done, right? At the end of Perek Mem, the last Perek of Sefer Shemot, we have one last command that God gives, set it up on the first day of the month. So we sort of arrive at the end of the Sefer, we arrive at the end of the book, knowing exactly what to expect, but we're watching in rapt attention. It's really very dramatic. And again, you know, we don't have hours to do this, but you'll read it, you'll see it. The spotlight is totally on Moshe. Right, even the special korban, the korban olah that was offered at this time, Rashi says on pasuk chavtet, the korban was brought by Moshe. There's no one else on the stage. It's a very dramatic highlight. Bezalel, who was endowed with the powers of God, like we said at the beginning, who was responsible for much of the construction, has no appearance. And we watch Moshe carefully, meticulously, and lovingly, with a sense of awe, fear, moving around the stage, putting everything together, step by step by step. And in the end, that's when we hear, Vayicha Moshe etz hamlacha, everything is in its exact place. It's a very dramatic movement. And I think, you know, we think of this parak, there's a lot of details, but actually there's a ton of drama in the sequence as every small detail is built, is put in its place. And then suddenly when it's all constructed, then and only then, Vayichas Hanan et Oel Moed uKvod Hashem Malei etz HaMishkan, only once the vessels all come together do they become a structure, a holistic structure, where the significance of which far exceeds all the individual parts, right? It all fuses together, and the cloud of God, right, of the kavod of Anan does not rest on the menorah or on the mizbeach or even the aron by itself, but only on the mishkan as a whole. And I want to end with one source here that describes really the relationship between the whole and the composite parts. And there's a very famous disagreement, machloket, and this is from Gemara and Brachot, Daf Nun Hei Amud Aleph, the Babylonian Talmud, Brachot, Tractate Brachot, 55a, where we see, distinct opinions between what's the relationship between the kelim, the individual vessels, and the entirety of the structure of the Mishkan itself. And I'll read it We'll read it together with you. Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yonatan. Betzalel al shem chachmato nikra. Right? Betzalel was called by his name, Betzel El, on account of his wisdom. What was so wise about Betzalel? Bisha'a she'amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe, lech emor lo leBetzalel, aseli mishkan aron v'kelim, halach Moshe v'hafach v'amar lo, asei aron v'kelim u'mishkan. God said to Moshe, go tell Betzalel, make a tabernacle, an ark, and the vessels. And when Moshe went to Betzalel, he actually reverses the order. And he says to Betzalel, make the ark, the vessels, and then the tabernacle. And Moshe said, Amar lo, in the Hebrew, I'm on the third line. Amar lo, Betzalel responds, Moshe Rabbeinu, minhago shel olam, adam bone bayit, v'char kach machnis l'tocho kelim. V'ata omer, asali aron v'kelim u'mishkan, kelim shani oseh, l'hechan achnisem. Betzalel says, Moshe, what are you telling me? The standard practice for anybody is that a person builds a house, and only afterwards do you put the furniture, do you put the vessels inside of the house. And you're telling me, make the ark, the vessels, and the mishkan. If I do it in the order that you're telling me, then when I make the vessels, where am I going to put them, right? Perhaps God told you the following, make the tabernacle, the ark, and then the vessels, which is actually what God told Moshe, right? Moshe flips the order. And then Moshe says to Betzalel, and that's how he says, Shema Betzalel, Hayita V'Yadata. He says, perhaps you were Betzalel, you were in God's shadow, and you knew precisely what he said. You heard it, you understood it, you intuited God's command just as he stated them, as if you were there. Let's unpack this for just 1 second, and then we'll close up together. There's a difference here, and I call it house first or furniture first, right? Moshe seems to have thought of the kelim, the vessels, as the focus, and the overall mishkan as something like a container for them. And the container in Moshe's mind is an afterthought, right? God tells him, make a mishkan and all the vessels. And when Moshe gives the instruction, he says, I'm going to stop the share, sorry, so I could see your faces. When he says, when he gets the instructions and he repeats to Betzalel, he says, right, he repeats with that little bit of a difference, and he puts the kelim first. Betzalel has a totally different perspective. He says, right, he understood something that Moshe did not understand. He says, the mishkan is the house itself, and the vessels are the furnishings. A house with no vessels is an incomplete home. But furnishings, vessels without a house are really nothing at all. And I think that sort of reflects the two perspectives of Moshe and Betzalel depicted in this segment in the Gemara, right? On the Mishkan. Moshe is emphasizing the individual kelim because he sees the entirety of the Mishkan as just a way of protecting the kelim. But the real purpose is the avodah, the work that's to be done with the vessels, to light the menorah each day, to burn the incenses, the korbanots that are offered. And so from that perspective, from Moshe's perspective, it's the service, right? It's the avodah. And that the kelim need to be the focus of our attention. So even though God says to him, build the mishkan first, Moshe flips it because in his mind, what's most essential here are the vessels for the service. And Betzalel offers a different perspective. He says the Mishkan is first and foremost a home. It's, as the Ramban puts it in Sefer Shmot, the Ramban early on says that the Mishkan is a portable Har Sinai. It's the place for the divine presence to rest. And as such, the overall structure comes first, because that's ultimately what this is. It's a home. And then you put the vessels inside the home. And I think in so many ways, we talked about tensions and dichotomies in all different ways from the very beginning. It's a theme throughout the end in certain ways. But we have the same thing here. Both perspectives are very true, right? Each kli had specific instructions, specific dimensions, specific materials in order to exist as a vessel. And the impressiveness of it all is when each The menorah, the aron with its details and materials is a masterpiece in its own right. And there's a certain sublime beauty when they're arranged just so, right? There's something that happens when each of those vessels, that's when it becomes, the Mishkan becomes a chariot for the presence of the divine. But on the other hand, we have the question of the home that holds it all. If you don't have a home, those things are beautiful, but where are they going? What are they doing? And I think, you know, this model in many ways, first of all, at this moment when we don't have our sacred spaces and we don't have our homes, all we have are the kelim, all we have are the vessels, the people, the individuals, the rites. I feel a little bit like this is a Moshe moment, right? Moshe's focusing on all the vessels, all the people, all the things that make the Mishkan what the Mishkan is. But on the other hand, we've all missed our sacred spaces, our homes, our places that are permanent, that are accessible, that we know where to go for community. But I think it's also, you know, this very much expresses relationship with the divine, but also our relationship with one another, right? What are our roles as individuals within larger frameworks, within families, within communities? We begin as kelim, we begin as individuals, right? There's no place to begin other than the individual. And of course, every individual is born with context, with family, with community. Nobody develops entirely alone, but that's sort of the dichotomy of having each individual being the most beautiful, spectacular kli that it can be, having each individual being the most spectacular individual they can be, and at the same time, living in the home and existing as part of the community and contributing to the home. And so creation of the world is an act of an individual, really, right? When we go back to Bereshit, where we started, Bereshit Perek Aleph, that it's Hashem, it's God on the scene. It's the creation of an individual, but the work and the building of the Mishkan is the work of a community. It's the power of bringing the individuals and the communities together. And of course, the individual being developed in the structure of community, and community can really only be built when the individuals come together. And so the Moshe and Bezalel tension reflects that, where neither can overshadow the other. And it's true in all of our relationships. And once those relationships are aligned, then we're blessed with the presence of the divine, the imprint of the divine, and the Shekhinah, which rests over the entirety of that sacred space. I'm looking at the time and exactly 1 hour, so I want to be mindful of the lateness of the hour. I know we hit a lot of different themes in conceptions of sacred space. I hope we were able to tie some of them together. And I think that, you know, the main takeaway is that a structure which could sometimes feel like it's not accessible, it's not something that's in our religious consciousness, we don't have it now. Actually, when we think about what the different depictions, what the different conceptions, the different arrangements are, speaks very deeply to all those questions that we started with at the beginning. How does this impact how we move through space? Who makes these decisions? Is it an individual? Is it community? How can we align the interests so that we have the most sacred dwelling, both as individuals and as communities? So I invite everyone to reflect on those ideas. I'm happy to continue conversations another time. I'm looking now in the chat for some questions. Do we have a couple minutes for questions, or?
We always do. I don't think there are too many questions, but we always have time for questions and, you know, stay. I want to take a look. Yeah.
Raise the diagram. Okay, sorry that the diagram, everyone has sources. And again, I'm happy to share any other, there's a lot of articles and different resources that can illuminate this conversation.
Thank you very much. Really very interesting, inspiring, and different share, if I could say, you know, a little bit out of the sort of mold that I think people are used to listening, and very nice, you know, tying in the Parsha, and of course, our spaces over the last years, which hopefully will grow. We'll be able to go more spaces with more people. And anyways, thank you very much. A pleasure.
And of course,
shalom and regards. And of course, next week, next week, Sunday, Menachem Leib Tag and Benny Gesundheit back on Pesach 11:15 and 12:30. And then on Monday, Malka Simcha, which has finished her course on the Apocrypha, the last Apocrypha. The Apocrypha, and then at 1:15, Harav Amnon Bazak, Yavir Shir Bivrit, Al Keneged Arba Banim, Dibrat Rab Shatu Drash, so Kulam Muzpanim, Zebachat, Imivinim Ivrit, Kulam Muzpanim, Lo Mivinim Ivrit, and the I'll talk to you, the Seder, and then continuing all through the week, just watch it for the emails and come to the Shurim. Lori Novak's course is over, but Shuli Mishkin will be having her class on Thursday, and Marty Lushin's class is over. Please head into the Pesach and into Bein HaZmanim always, but we'll keep you busy with learning, and a pleasure to see everybody. Like I always say, invite your friends, and okay, we'll look forward. Everybody should have a Shabbat Shalom. You will be healthy, and thank you, Shira.
Of course. Shabbat
Shalom.
Thank you, Tova, again. Thank you for the sponsorship, and thank everybody for coming, and everybody who will.
Shira, thank you very much.
Good night.
Thank you.
It was a wonderful shir.
Thank you. I know, a little difference. I try to be a little different.
We ate it. Wonderful.
Rabbi Alman, you got to let us know when you're giving your Dvar Torah. I'm still waiting for it.
Not a problem.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll have to do it at the beginning of the shir one day, but before Pesach, hopefully.
Shira, I have a question if everybody else is finished.
That was
excellent. I really enjoyed it. A different take and the focus on the sacred space, but only in a positive way. So that was really special. But my real question is, I want to see your lighting set up.
You have a $10 IKEA lamp.
It's shining on you?
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm in a room that's like, sometimes it's not so
important. No, it's amazing. It's fantastic. Now it's not as good. You moved
it. Exactly. I'm showing it to you. Literally, it's like a $10 junkie lamp, and I put it behind the computer and just shine it on my face.
I'm taking a photography class now, and the teacher was also beautifully lit this week. So what she did, she shone her lamp away from her, and she had foam core to reflect it more softly on her face.
Yeah, well, that's yeah.
Right. So I know
I'm like a photographer in my.
I know you're a photographer. That's why I'm like realizing this didn't happen by accident. You're beautifully lit in front of a dark background. So.
And the light is on top. That's like very. It's a little bit harsh. It's cool, but it's very harsh. You could also get like the
ring lamps. Yeah.
Something lamps, but this is $10 at IKEA, and we also on.
I see. I know you have in your bio how you like tennis, so I see the tennis ball right behind you.
It's signed by many, many players over the 10 years.
So who's the most famous player who signed it?
Oh gosh, I don't even. I think we have Rafa, I believe, on there. He might be the most famous. I don't even remember. Victoria Azarenka is on there.
So I'm going to tell you. I'm going to date myself a little bit. I've only been. I think once to a real tennis match. I don't think I went to practice something in Toronto, and that was between Borg and McEnroe in the US Open many years ago. That was like before you were born almost.
So we have like a tradition every year to when we were right here. So we go to the US Open early, we go always during the qualifying rounds because it's free. And you could just walk everywhere and see.
So we got that in Toronto.
And then we go to the match. We go to the Open the first week because that's when you have the most. You can go from 10 o'clock in the morning till midnight.
You can also afford it probably more.
But it's still pretty expensive.
It's still pretty expensive.
It's like, it's a lot for grounds. For Arthur, I think it's a
here
lot.
In the Canadian Open, they didn't have it last year, but they do for free. The day of qualifying. You can come in and go in for free and watch everybody. Anyways, so we've gone a couple times. But
Today we actually played a little bit right before this year. I brought my kids up tennis on Thursday night, the little guys, and Aaron, and we brought them and their courts outside. And we're like, just 20 minutes, you know, with my 16-year-old. We just needed to move. Too much computer.
It's beautiful today here in Toronto. Yeah. We hit 19 degrees here today.
It was very windy. It wasn't a tennis day. It was very.
Yeah, it wasn't a tennis day, but.
It's beautiful here. It was beautiful. Your lineup is just amazing. I have to say, I know we're being recorded, whatever. I'm assuming you'll chop it all up, but it's just, it's, you know, I don't go on at night to all the shiroom. It's just crazy in the house, whatever.
Well, but
you
course.
Have such a quality, like such a high quality. Well,
thank you. So thank you. I you know, yeah, I think second to that in a sense, I think the quality we have is amazing, really. And it's a tribute to all the speakers and, you know, and the people who come and listen and whatever. Yeah. So we're always looking for good speakers. We're always looking for more and different, you know, it's not always easy.
By the way, I second the motion. The quality is incredible.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. You know, so, okay. Well, pleasure for everybody's listening.
Seeing everyone in person. Yeah. Everybody who's on, hope you've enjoyed that.
Right. No, it's nice. Listen, there's a certain intimacy on Zoom. Sometimes you can get that you can't get in a regular shiur. I mean, I don't see people's bookshelves, you know, when we give a shiur here in Toronto. And, you know, you get to talk. I mean, I'm teaching every day, you know, chat online. And it's different, but you get to know it. It's in a certain way, the kids better.
Wait, chat's still online, totally?
No, so chat does like this. Chat has every other day. And it's two cohorts. So one cohort goes on Monday and Wednesday. The other goes on Tuesday, Thursday. Then it takes turns on Friday. So you're there half the time, but it's only two classes a day. That is three courses, a quadmester, four quadmesters. So 2 hours a day. The first 2 hours, first 4 hours in school, they don't want more than two cohorts. So everybody goes home. They have an extended lunch. I mean, it's not, you know, gotcha. So they go home. And then the third period of the day is totally on Zoom. So whatever. So you're on Zoom more than you're in the classroom in a different cohort, whatever. But it's working quite very well, I would say, compared to what was on the learning and everything. And, you know, and hopefully by September, please God, I'll be well, everybody. Back in school, regular things. I mean, you know, but there are, so that's how it's working at chat. I know in New York, I think all the schools are in person pretty much.
Yeah. I mean, my kids' SAR has been from the beginning, her Torah, the little kids also. SAR has one day a week, one grade. Every day there's a grade that's out.
Right, Frisch does the same thing, I think. Yeah.
And but after Pesach, I think they're not having any more Zoom days because they're enough.
Well, you see, where it's still on lockdown here, like Toronto opened up a little bit this week after a few months. So, I mean, you know, the schools were allowed to open in February. The schools were totally on Zoom from Christmas. I mean, they announced it for the Christmas break here. Until February the 15th or something. So for 6 weeks, the whole province was only online. But now when they're allowed school, so that's how chat does it. So the barbershops are closed. I haven't had a haircut in 7 months, you know, and the restaurants are still closed. I mean, takeout only. So yeah, we're much more locked down.
No. You know, it feels like just going to a cafe outside even. It just, I worked today. I got to get out of the house now finally. And it feels so sacred. It really feels like, you know, there's people and they turn the parking lot into like a sukkah. And today was a beautiful day. So everyone's just sitting and it feels so special. It's hard to even, like, it's very emotional.
I'll let you go, but I see Tova asked, I think I saw it flash by, reference to Zev Farber. I assume it's on Torah, on the Torah.
I'm not going to hear. I'll, here it is. Okay, let me just drop the link in. There's lots of other, if anybody asks, I mean, I have all the other articles.
If anybody has any specific, I mean, I always get in contact, I can always ask, you know.
We can post them on the website if you want to just send them.
So here, I am going to send this to, hang on 1 second. Here's the link of the Omoid. It was really interesting. I mean, it was like a side point, but I think it just, you know, when you think about Shmot, Lamed Gimel, and the Mishkan Omoid, what does that look like? But yeah, so that's the article. Of course. Alrighty. Well, thank you so much. Always so much fun.
Thanks a lot. Okay. Shabbat shalom, everybody.
Shira. Yes. I'm Rosie Friedman. It was beautiful. You have kids in Hartorah?
I have two little. I have older and younger. We
right. I think they are. My very active there. Davida Friedman Yehaskel. She just ran that evening Saturday night. Where do you live?
I like remembered Zavita Fro. I haven't seen her in a long time. I know that she's very involved.
Oh my gosh. So where do you live?
I live in Jamaica Estates.
Do you? Right. Okay. We live in Forest Hills. Okay. Very nice. Been there a lot. It's a great school. It's, and so you're attending SAR from after being in our Torah, one of them, right?
Yeah. So I have high school kids. Oh, well, one, my son is in 11th grade in SAR, and then I have a daughter in Israel for the year. But the little, we're local. I'm not going to schlep them.
You have a drill for the year?
Yeah.
Really? So do I. I have one in Mechlala.
Nice. Oh, my alma mater.
Maybe Ivana's, they know.
It's alma mater too. Okay.
I don't think they would be so proud of me, but okay.
No, it was a beautiful.
I wonder if the guest went to Michala.
Beautiful. Lovely shear. Ours is Eliora Fine. My daughter teaches in Shulamit, her mom. But they may know each other. What's her first name?
Dahlia Kohler.
Use both names. Hess Kohler.
Kohler.
Okay, very nice, beautiful, lovely. All right,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, Shabbat Shalom. All right. I think I'll end the session. It's not fair to Shira. She has to get ready for Shabbat.
I'm sure that I still have like a little guy running around. I'm perfectly happy for Aaron to do it.
Okay, we'll keep on the.
Elman also. Thank you so much.
Beautiful. All right, well, thank you, everyone. Looking forward to more opportunities.
Okay, bye bye.
Take care.